The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Glory America, bonjour, hi Canada, it's Hugh Hewitt, July the 19th in year of our Lord 2022. I've got so much coffee in me. I've been up since like 2 o'clock in the morning here on the East Coast because the rain in Maine came mainly on our house last night. I have no idea how much it rained last night, but it was buckets and buckets. Now, good rule of nationally syndicated talk radio is don't talk about the weather because nobody cares where you don't live because it's not the same thing. But we're going to talk about the weather today in Europe in just a moment. But I thought I would preface that by saying it's been extraordinarily wonderful at Studio North for the last month. But last night it was just, okay, we saved all the rain for last night. So I've been awake a long time. And no matter how much rain came down, it's not going to match the precipitous fall in Joe Biden's approval rating, according to CNBC. He has hit an all-time new low for his economic approval. He just doesn't know what he's doing. Donald Trump's economic approval bottomed out at 41%, according to CNBC. Barack Obama's at 37%. President Biden's has dropped to 30%. 30% for Joe Biden on the economy. You tell me who's going to win November's election. So the weather story, I mean, Europe is baking. And they're going to hit a record, if they haven't already hit a record, in Great Britain today, a 363-year record. They've only been tracking heat in the United Kingdom for 363 years, and it's going to get up to 104 today, I think. I think that's what it, you know, don't ask me to do centigrade Fahrenheit. I just don't do it. For the benefit of everyone, we should just go to Fahrenheit. We are the leader of the West, and we should just go to Fahrenheit. The highest official temperature currently has been 101.7 degrees Fahrenheit, and that happened last year, actually 3 years ago, 2019. But it's going to go up there today. Now, you say, well, is this a crisis? I don't think it is. I quote from the Washington Post, 104 degree Fahrenheit day in the United Kingdom is a once every 100 to 300 year event. It goes on to say, models predict such days could happen once every 15 years by 2100 if countries meet their carbon emission promises, or once every 3 or 4 years if they continue to emit as much pollution as they do today. So is that a crisis or is that a reality to be mitigated given that we need energy? Energy fuels quality of life. Energy is freedom. Energy is getting people out of dire poverty. Energy is building roads and houses and an apartment complex. Energy is everything. And so you can't just say we're not going to do energy, or unless you want to go back to, you know, prehistoric times. And we're not doing that. And, you know, people in the developing world do not want to do that. People do not want to live in huts with cook stoves emitting smoke. Their quality of life just sucks. And as the rain came down last night and I was awake, I was thinking about the fact there's a significant homeless population. I saw them on my one trip to Portland with Tony and Denise this week. And I see them everywhere. But, you know, in the summer, they're not dumb. They come north, too. And those who can, when they come out, I was thinking of people, you know, just getting deluged by the rain on the street. And then, you know, as happens at 2 o'clock in the morning, I begin thinking about the 70,000 people on the streets of Los Angeles who are baking and the 2.2 million people who are walking across the border, people who are actually impoverished beyond belief. And then you think about the people who are, quote, living rough in Great Britain and how hot it is. And you wonder, okay, it is a crisis for them, but life is a crisis for them. Are we really focused on the right things for human beings? And I'm not sure carbon emissions ranks above housing those people in a utilitarian sense or in a liberty sense or in a Christian sense or any kind of religious sense. I just don't think models forecasting climate doom inform daily choices very much. But boy, are we going to hear a lot about it. New York Times, extreme heat puts life on hold in Britain, a land not built for it. You know, actually, they had a parliamentary session yesterday, so it didn't put that on hold. And the Tories got down to four candidates. Tom Tuggenhut was voted off the Prime Minister Island, as was expected. And today they're going to have another vote. And Kemi Badenoch is not expected to survive. But Michael Gove, who's the smartest member of the British Parliament, is out there pitching her. And he went on one of the Brit stations yesterday on LBC with Andrew Marr and made this pitch about Kemi Badenoch. Cut number one, Michael Gove.
To be fair, she has more ministerial experience than Tony Blair or David Cameron had when they became prime minister. And she's been
in... They had run a party, of course.
Indeed.
A big job.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And also, she's the same age as Rishi, and she's been in government in three very different roles, all of which she's accomplished successfully. I know all of the candidates. I've either worked with them because they've been junior ministers in departments that I've been running, or they've supported me in previous leadership elections. I have no hesitation in saying that of all of the people who worked with me in a department that I ran, Kemi was undoubtedly the outstanding minister. She has an intellectual grasp second to none. She has a capacity to communicate with confidence, but also with empathy. And also, she's brave. It's a rare junior minister who tells their Secretary of State where to get off because that Secretary of State is getting something wrong. Kemi did that to me repeatedly. Now, there were a number of occasions where I told her that I disagreed. She took it in very good part. But it's that confidence based on an understanding from first principles of what you want to achieve that you need in a leader.
You clearly like her, but it would be one heck of a gamble, wouldn't it?
Well, we have in front of us, I think, a range of good candidates. And as I say, I've worked with them all and I respect them all. But I think that Kemi has something special. And she reminds me in a way, even though her politics are different, of both David Cameron and Ruth Davidson. I supported David Cameron in 2005 when there were only about five or six MPs who were, because I knew that he had star quality. I remember Ruth Davidson when she was running for the leadership of the Scottish Conservatives. She had only one member of the Scottish Parliament supporting her. But when I saw her, I thought, she's the star, she's going to win. And Kemi has something of the same qualities.
And you feel the same thing. Explain to me how she gets into the final two, because looking at the numbers, I just can't see it.
Well, I think that some of the votes from Suella Braverman will go to Kemi today. I think that some of the other candidates have backers who are feeling buyer's remorse. And who may well come to Kemi. I also think that the logic of many of the people who've been supporting Tom Tuggenhut, a friend of mine, the logic of wanting a clean start, I think, would incline them towards Kemi. So everything could align. It is possible. And I think that ultimately one of the things we've seen during this race is the more that people see of Kemi, the more impressed they are.
That's a very good summary by Michael Gove, who I repeatedly tell you is the smartest guy in the British government. And today they will have a fourth round of the four remaining contenders between noon and two. And noon, of course, there is very early here. So we will find out probably around 3 o'clock their time, mid-morning here in the United States. And those three... we'll go another round. I'm not sure when the next round is. Maybe it's in a couple of days. But right now, Rishi Sunak has 115 votes. Penny Mordaunt has 82. Liz Truss has 71. And Kemi Badenoch has 58. Mr. Tuggenhut's 31 are free agents. And anyone can change their mind any time. There's a lot of strategic voting going on. The Brits just get down to two, and then they ask the 200,000 official members of the Tory party. And I do not know how you become to pick. And if you were picking on best for American conservatives, you would pick Kemi. Absolutely. She's the she's right in the strike zone of American politics right now, being anti-woke and articulating a reason why that matters. If you have no idea why that matters, the hot air story on what is going on in schools is really eye-opening. It's written, it quotes from a leftist. And if you go to hotair.com, you'll be able to find it. Or if you look at my Twitter feed down a little bit, you'll see progressive public school teacher in a blue state. Things are as bad as you've heard. John Sexton wrote this piece yesterday, quoting a Substack piece by Wesley Yang, who's not the actual author. The actual author is anonymous, a leftist, a big one. I hate capitalism. I support abortion on demand. I unironically use phrases like systems of oppression in the dominant culture. The last big paper I put together for my undergraduate degree is on critical race theory. But my fellow leftists are still willing to try that just incredibly deranged ideological maneuvers, including giving white kids lower grades purposefully in order to close the racial equity gap. And so when Kemi Badenoch in the United Kingdom is campaigning as a black woman, as a UK Londoner born in London but raised in Nigeria, against wokeism, she would be good for the West generally. Provided they keep Ben Wallace on as Minister of Defense, I could live with any of them. Don't go anywhere, America. I'll be right back. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined by David M. Drucker, the Washington Examiner chief political correspondent for them. David, I'm talking about a Wall Street Journal essay by, or a reporting essay, Rachel Feinzing. You can't make up for lost time, but these parents are trying. That, and you're a parent, so I really wanted to ask you, and I'm going to ask Byron York this next hour as well. Do you think the COVID years were as cataclysmic as 9/11 or impactful as the Kennedy assassination or the Vietnam protest? I mean, did they really, are they that disruptive that you feel obliged to splurge on big, big things that your kids missed?
Well, Hugh, you know, I've been pondering this because I think my wife and I were very lucky. My boys had each other. We had each other. And the four of us, with a couple of other, with one particular family in particular, but even with members of my extended family, tried to do things to mitigate the impact of COVID. Certain kinds of traveling, certain kinds of gatherings, getting out of the house on a regular basis. But I think I realized that for many people, it wasn't as easy. And they either didn't feel comfortable doing some of the things we did or were not able to for medical or financial reasons. So many people that were in industries that depended on people gathering and traveling lost their jobs and saw reduced incomes. And so in some ways, I feel like I just endured it and didn't think about it and thought, well, one day I'm going to look back on this. But I think for a lot of people, the more I think about it and talk to people about it, as we think about it and talk about it in retrospect, I think it was that for them. And I think we're not going to know the complete impact of it for quite a long time.
Now, obviously, for some people, we stipulate people died. And so obviously that's it's a parent dying. That's the worst possible situation. But I also know that in the great pandemic of 1918, more people died and nobody ever talked about it. The Great Influenza book describes that. It was, oh, that was something to be endured. It was not the Great Depression generation. It was not the World War II generation. The pandemic generation was not the, it was the World War I generation, David. And so I think, we do obsess about what happens to us in the now, as opposed to taking a longer view about where it fits in on all this. Sort of like the headlines coming out of Europe today about the hottest day ever. And we'll obsess on that for a while, and then we'll move on. It's the Instagram age is what it is. And I think Instagram actually has more of a massive impact on kiddos and the generation that is rising than the COVID years ever will.
Yeah, I worry about that. You know, my boys are young, but people, I used to think, you know, it makes me sound, you know, like kids today, but then there's such an obsession with self, you know. I take pictures. I put kids and food and sometimes political campaign coverage on Instagram. I try as hard as I can to never put myself on Instagram. So you wonder where all this is going to lead. You know, I think you can see the difference between our pandemic and the pandemic of 2018 is a different expectation of health. We expect to be healthy. We expect
that's very
infected. We live in an age of vaccines and treatments. And, you know, at that period in history, as innovative as it was for the time, and there are still, I've read about this because of our pandemic, there are architectural designs of buildings in New York in particular and others that are relate to what people learned or experienced during that pandemic. They didn't expect to live a life free of medical challenges because they didn't have the technology.
You are so on spot here. Expectations drive the significance level. Because if your expectation of infant mortality is significantly higher in 1918, but it did shock them, but they're coming out of a world war. And our expectation today is the curated life that we see on Instagram, which isn't really life at all, right? You don't
not at all.
What is that, Joni Mitchell? You really don't know life at all if you know life through Instagram. You don't.
Yeah. And look, we have a 24-hour news cycle that can beam every horrible human tragedy into our house as though it's happening next door. And it just changes the way you look at things. But, you know, in 1918 and in the 20s, they couldn't seal themselves off hermetically in their house and get things delivered in boxes. So you just had to live. But we
When the caskets were piling up in Philadelphia, they could not bury the dead in Philadelphia. There were so many people dying in the 1918 influenza that they could not bury the dead, and they stacked them up outside. And that generation did not talk about it the way mine does, the Kennedy assassination, as being a thing to her. And people will be a little bit nostalgic. Watch, this will be long after I'm off the air, right? 20 years from now, they'll be a little bit nostalgic about the COVID years if they got through them unscathed. You agree with me, David?
Yeah. Yeah, to some degree. Or maybe, you know, maybe it depends on what age the kids are and they'll remember how they get to stay home every day. But I think it also depends on, again, my kids had each other. My boys are 3 years apart. And I sometimes like think how lucky I am that they had each other to play with and interact with. So they weren't bereft for 2 years of social interaction. The headmaster at our school believed in on-campus education. So they got to go back relatively soon. Didn't have the same challenges that other kids are still having.
Yeah, or and they weren't in the Baltimore school system, which I just was reading an article about, has failed so spectacularly that maybe they'll do something about it. Attorney Crump is up there trying to sue them into doing something in Baltimore. David M. Drucker on Twitter. Thank you, David. Go and read if you haven't yet. I'd love to have your essay on the essay because it's a big deal. We'll be right back, America. It's you doing. Morning glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. Voting has gotten underway among British Tory members of parliament for the new prime minister round three. Not yet. I mean, you don't pick the final one until September, but they're down to four. Rishi Sunak, Penny Mordaunt, Liz Truss, and Kemi Badenoch, and it's begun. They've got 358 members have got to cast their ballot. No one knew in 1975 that when Margaret Thatcher defeated former Prime Minister Heath to run the Conservative Party that it prefigured a revolution. It prefigured Ronald Reagan. It prefigured the fall of the Soviet Union, the rise of everything. Nobody knew that in 1975. Today could be that day that people look back in 50 years. I'm joined by Byron York. Good morning, Byron. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. I'm fine.
Are you following the British parliamentary election closely?
Not as much as the heat wave, as a matter of fact. And well, I was also listening to you speaking to David Drucker before about the lasting effects of the pandemic, which I thought was a pretty fascinating conversation.
Well, I want to go there with you. I just wanted to update people that the voting has begun. I've rethought how to frame this, Byron. In every life, there's a best year and a worst year, right? There is a horrible year and a terrible year, and there's a really great year. Will the COVID years be the, quote, worst years for the generation the way that 1930, 31, 32 were for my parents and maybe 9/11 was for us? Will it be the worst year?
Well, we don't know. We don't know what's coming. Something really, really terrible could be coming. Listen, I think that the COVID years revealed some really troubling things about our society and the way things work. You know, personally, I'm not going to complain about not being able to take a vacation. I was very lucky to have a job that I could already do at home, and anybody who watches cable TV saw that a lot of people started appearing on television from their homes. So it just wasn't a huge thing. But, you know, I think that what was done in the schools and what was done with the economy were really, really troubling. I think that COVID revealed an authoritarian streak in a lot of our political and public health elites. Showed a kind of a dangerous and heavily ideological groupthink in the public health establishment. It showed the politicization of public health issues. I think a lot of these were really, really troubling, and we're going to be looking at those for years and years and years and trying to figure out why people did what they did during the COVID years.
It also stripped bare the public education establishment. A lot of clarity was arrived at from parents beholding how the teachers union manipulated shutdowns and what was being taught because they were looking over their kids' shoulders. There are certainly enduring effects. I mean, I think President Trump did not win re-election because of COVID. I don't know how you beat an incumbent with 3% unemployment and 2-3% inflation and the strongest economy maybe of my lifetime, certainly of my lifetime, unless COVID comes along and destroys it all and they choose to shut down the government. And we made every wrong choice possible except Operation Warp Speed and getting the vaccinations done. But Byron, for the kids, those who lost 2 years of bad schools are maybe not as damaged as those who lost 2 years of good schools who come from bad homes. So you might have a four square box, good home, bad school, good school. And I'll tell you how it plays out. But I don't think it's a 9/11 level set of memories collectively. I don't think it's the worst years.
Well, no, 9/11 was 9/11 set off. It reoriented our role in the world. It set off a war on terror that existed for more than 20 years. It set off a security regime at our airports and other places. It really set off huge changes. On the other hand, the COVID changes were really, really damaging. And what happened in the schools, and you're right, it did expose the teachers' unions, but what happened in the schools, I think, were an example of the sort of failure of public policy in dealing with this, with the COVID threat. The personal tragedies that existed during COVID, people who died alone because the authorities would not allow their relatives to be near them in their final hours. I mean, just crazy things.
Byron, let me broach a very, I want to be very careful how I make this analogy. In Uvalde, we saw paralysis on the part of, I think, 400 law enforcement officers.
Yeah.
And in the COVID years, and that paralysis resulted in massive loss of life and tragedy. And maybe some of that couldn't have been prevented, but certainly the response, the paralyzed inability to act, led to the death of children who died from bleeding out and teachers who died from bleeding out. The paralysis at the public health level and at the public education level led to terrible consequences. And I think that's what you're referring to, is that groupthink will kill things if we're not careful of it. But it saved a lot of lives in getting Operation Warp Speed gone. You know, I firmly believe the vaccine is very good for the world. And, you know, China is still struggling because it's not vaccinated with effective vaccines. But we aren't. So where do we land on this?
Well, I think Operation Warp Speed struck me as kind of the last gasp of a World War II style operation in the American government, in part because President Trump, just born in 1946, heard heroic tales of World War II. He admired American generals in World War II. He just had this sort of view of what he had thought World War II was. And one of the things that the United States did to win World War II was we had this enormous industrial capacity, which we expanded, and we weren't too careful about efficiency. We just threw money at the problem. And that's what Operation Warp Speed did. They knew a lot of the money would not turn out. They funded multiple research projects at a single time. They cut corners all over the place in terms of bureaucracy, and it worked. And so I almost think of Operation Warp Speed as this the last World War II.
Well, that's very insightful. States. The Arthur Herman's book on what we did to get the arsenal of democracy up and running underscores the truth of what you just said. In terms of children 30 years out, I think it's nostalgia. I think it's hula hoop. They will forget the pain. That's what happened in the 1918 pandemic. They will forget the pain and they will remember the uniqueness.
Maybe. Yes, they will. They absolutely will. There were kids. Their lives didn't change. They've gone on, and that's fine. But I think we have to look at the way we dealt with a public health threat. Was it as big a threat as we treated it? Should we have looked at it differently? This was a big deal. I heard you discussing the 1918 flu epidemic, where people simply didn't make as big a deal of it, even though it was, you know, devastating public health crisis. I think we have to look at the way our government handled this thing, and it was, you know, the way the public health establishment, once they had vaccines, really de-emphasized treating sick people. The way some public health authorities advocated sort of penalizing the unvaccinated. I mean, the politicization.
You know, Byron, we're not going to get that assessment because it doesn't fit the narrative of legacy media. I mean, we really need a search. They won't do what you're talking about because it does not fit the legacy that DC knows what it's doing. Right.
It'll take years. It will actually take years. But there are voices. I mean, obviously, there are voices now. And I'm not talking about anti-vax voices. I'm talking about public health voices who are looking and thinking, what did we do? Was it the right thing? Why did the public health establishment think this and think that? So I think that there will be better assessments of public policy during the COVID years within the next 10 years.
I also think it will lead to net assessment. Like if you get Brian Westbury says we can never shut down the economy this way again. And yeah, net assessment is what you need when you, for example, talk about climate policy. You can't just say stop emissions because that has net disaster for the developing world. It's just net assessment has got to become, what am I not seeing? And Byron, I just don't see that in political figures.
No. And I think that looking at, I mean, COVID remains a problem now. If you look at the number of new cases, if you look at the graph starting back in February of 2020, going all the way to today, it remains a problem now, but the public has decided they're not going to shut down because of it.
Agreed. And I don't think we will ever shut down absent an Ebola-like situation. Byron York on Twitter, on Fox, and in the Washington Examiner. Get his newsletter every day from DCExaminer.com. Thank you, Byron. Coming right back, America, on The Hugh Hewitt Show. I want to remind you that our sponsor is AndrewandTodd.com. They're with Sierra Pacific. They lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to AndrewandTodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Morning, Glory America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. Live from Studio Winterfell in the far north, I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined by Garrity, the indispensable Jim Garrity of NationalReview.com. And Jim, I asked you to stay for two segments today because we got a list to go through. Let me tell you what we got to cover. Sort of like knowing what's on the president's physical fitness test when you're in sixth grade. We got to figure out how low can Joe Biden go because he's an all-time new low for economic competency at 30%. Will we get another Thatcher out of the British parliamentary change? Are the children of COVID rather like the children of the corn? And then the media numbers in Gallup yesterday have touched all-time lows. So I got four things. Let's start with Joe, because you wrote about it at length yesterday. It was kind of awful to read. I felt bad for Joe Biden after you were done dismembering him.
I was mostly, you know, using the trip to Saudi Arabia as the jumping off point. And it's interesting you use that term because, look, you and I.
That's terrible.
You and I and lots of listeners to this podcast, or this program, probably always have this sense of Biden, what's he doing now? But watching him just get absolutely pantsed by the Saudis, basically get a handful of magic beans and promises in exchange for genuine concessions of the fist bump and the restoration of MBS's, you know, image on the world stage, he really looks like the bully getting the sand kicked in his face.
Yep.
And as an American, I don't like that. I want the American president to be respected on the world stage. And this is one step away from MBS saying, dance, monkey, dance. You know, you're going to dance, and I'm going to give you maybe I'll give you a little bit of oil next month. We'll see how I feel about it. You know, it was really one of the rare moments of watching Biden. No, then of course he says, "Oh, I stood up to him behind closed doors." Now, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. I hope he did. I hope this isn't Biden being conciliatory in the actual meeting. And then, you know,
and we should tell people, just because the Saudis say that didn't happen doesn't mean it didn't happen.
Correct. You know, it's very much in the Saudis' interest to say, ah, I don't remember him saying anything about that, you know.
Yeah. So, well, so again, number one, 30%. Can he go any lower? I mean, there's actually a statistical wall here.
Yeah. No, I'm going to say he can go lower because it's now becoming socially acceptable for Democrats to say, yeah, I don't have faith in this guy anymore.
Good.
This is not what I expected.
Because if
you're a Republican hoping for big wins in the midterms, now you have to worry about whether Democrats say, well, it's all Biden's fault. We picked a loser. We got a lemon. He's terrible, but I can still vote for my local Democratic, you know, officials.
Look, I'm already worried about overconfidence. I am. I'm already worried about overconfidence because people think the schools are already fixed and they're not. Let me go to that. This parental panic that the Wall Street Journal has written about today. You are the parent of youngsters, and I am the grandparent of youngsters, and I'm not worried about what they went through in the last 2 years because they didn't lose a parent. They weren't one of the unlucky ones, one of the tragic ones. But the Wall Street Journal essay is about parents splurging to make up for lost time. I mean, this was not the Great Depression for children generally. It was bad.
Oh, Hugh, I'm going to have a rare moment of strong disagreement here.
All right, go ahead. Okay. Go. Shoot.
Sure. Yes, it's not the same as losing a parent. I don't want to, you know, downplay the seriousness for those who did lose a parent, either from COVID or anything else. But speaking to a counselor that works with kids and teenagers and basically said, socially and developmentally, almost everybody's 2 years behind where they otherwise would be.
Well, I can stipulate to that. Oh, I agree. I agree.
But
let me ask it this way.
Moodiness. I mean, basically just interacting with people, everything that usually happens during those 2 years. We had 1 year in which basically school didn't occur. And then the next year you had, you know, semi-opening, slow opening here in Fairfax County. They went back. We had 1 week, which they said was a snow closure, but it just happened to align with when Omicron was terrible. It took a long time to get the kids out of masks. People haven't seen facial expressions on each other for a long time. It's been a long, slow process of coming back. And that's not even getting to the learning loss and all that kind of
stuff. Now, the learning loss is significant, and everything you talk about is real. But I want to ask you, when your kids are your age, not my age, your age, when they're your age, will they look back at the COVID years as the two worst years of their life, generally speaking, for that generation?
I think probably that first year where you weren't allowed to go out and see your friends, where you couldn't go out of school, you couldn't have anybody over. All the parents around you were freaking out. You had to have, you know, food delivered or, you know, you had to wear masks and all that kind of stuff. I mean, the other thing is like, you know, as you know, my kids are blessed with the best parents in the whole wide world.
Yeah.
But, you know, like for the, you know, there are other parents here in Authenticity Woods who went to DEFCON 1, who were fully very much the wearing two masks, were washing down our groceries and all that kind of stuff. So if you see your parents freaking out, believing they could die at any moment if, you know, they don't wipe down something properly. Like, yeah, it's going to give you anxiety.
I didn't know you lived in Authenticity. I thought you were over in the Virtue Terraces. And so I didn't know you were in Authenticity Woods in D.C. That's okay. That's a small world. All right. Now, look, we got to move on because I got to do one other thing with you before we go to the Thatcherite moment or not. And that is that Gallup has a new poll out yesterday that shows trust in media is at an all-time low of 16%. Great trust in media is at all-time low of 16%. And, of course, the number of Republicans who have confidence, great deal, is at 5%, Democrats at 35%, independents at 12%. It's fallen off the floor, Jim. They've reached statistical lows I did not think was possible. What does that tell you?
I think one thing it tells me is that when you're asked about the media, I suspect a lot of people's first thought is whatever media drives them crazy the most. Maybe it's CNN, maybe it's the New York Times, maybe it's NBC or something like that. If people said, is there media you trust? They'd probably say yes. And if there's, what media do you trust? I'm pretty sure they'd say the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Yeah, of course they would.
I hope they say National Review. I hope they say, you know, certain things that they like, maybe Fox News or something like that. And, you know, so people say, all right, so what people now associate media with the ones they dislike the most. And look, let's face it, CNN, the New York Times, Washington Post, USA Today, MSNBC, those are all big, NPR, those are all big and powerful and influential institutions. No two ways about that. But I think people are now, and everybody, whatever case is worst in their mind, maybe it's Dan Rather, maybe it's BuzzFeed or something, whatever the worst journalism they've ever, Chris Cuomo, whatever example is worst, that's one that's going to stick in their mind. And they're going to say, oh my goodness, how this place is going down the tubes. I can't trust them. They make stuff up. They exaggerate. They don't cover the stuff that's really important.
Those brands that you named, Jim, yeah. I clump under legacy media. Yeah. And I suggest to you that the attempt to manipulate and curate our news is now so pervasive and obvious. It's not even subtle anymore. My favorite example of the morning is the New York. I got to find it for you because it's just really quite a remarkable headline about abortion in the black communities. It doesn't really cook in the black community the way it does in progressive land. The traditional African-American church, for example, is not really sold on abortion. And so here it is. Democrats navigate nuanced views on abortion among black voters. This is an article in the New York Times today. Faced with a streak of conservatism about abortion among some black Americans, a vital constituency for President Biden, Democrats are framing the issue as part of a broader civil rights struggle. Now, that is a narrative, Jim.
Yeah.
and you know, it's so obviously a narrative as opposed to saying we have to lie to blacks about our abortion agenda, which is what that really is.
This is what you should think of this, right? This is what, you know, and on the one hand, is it good to know this is what the Democrats are attempting to sell? This is a strategy. Sure. But it's a largely friendly, you know, we're going to carry that message ahead for you.
Yes.
It's different if the, you know, well, here's how Republicans are attempting to exploit the, you know, conservative streak in the African-American community.
Well, contrast it with the gun story this morning. We'll come back and do Brits afterward. The gun story this morning about the hero in Indianapolis. Three people are dead, but but for the civilian. And the headline on New York Times down is police praise him. Then it goes over to what he stopped. And in the Washington Post, it's, oh, my gosh, people are running around with guns stopping killers. Rampage in Indiana, a rare instance of armed civilian ending mass shooting. That's curated, Jim.
First of all, Hugh, I hope he doesn't have anything controversial posted on his social media.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
Because then we'll know about it. We will know.
We will know. He won't be a hero for long.
He's a teen, you know, anything like that. It's one of those things where, look, almost all issues are actually more complicated than they seem, much more complicated than a party platform would make you think. So in other words, are there people out there who have guns who should? And sure, right? We've seen that in Highland Park and places like that. Boy, I would love it if parents would stop signing off on their children getting guns when they know the children have all kinds of emotional and psychological issues. But in this case, there are armed citizen stories. My friend Cam Edwards does usually one a day on his program, at least he used to. And there's this, you know, if you acknowledge it, like, okay, sometimes good people use guns, sometimes bad people use guns.
Yep. But if you acknowledge it, you're helping destroy lives and proliferate guns. It's just like the media has lost the confidence of the American people because they've lost their neutrality. I'll be right back to find out whether this is Thatcher 2.0 day in the United Kingdom. Does Kemi come out on top? Jim Garrity is here to divine what the Brits are doing, even as we speak on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. Big Jim Garrity is with us. Jim Garrity at Twitter. Garrity the Indispensable, we call him. Jim, I want to read you Niall Ferguson, historian extraordinaire, Hoover Institution fellow, tweeted just minutes ago, after we went to break, in fact. The rise of the very talented Kemi Badenoch is truly remarkable. She would be a Tory Obama if she won this. The whole leadership contest is a disaster for the bogus narrative that Brexit was motivated by racism and or nostalgia for empire. Because, I mean, it's Rishi Sunak and three women, one of them is black and was born in London and raised in Nigeria, Kemi Badenoch. You know, in 1975, nobody thought that the conservatives had changed history when they put Margaret Thatcher in front of their party. But they had. You think that's happening now, or is Rishi good enough?
Of the four options, they're all going to, quote unquote, look different than Boris Johnson and David Cameron and most of the folks who've been leading the Conservative Party since Margaret Thatcher.
And Gordon Brown and every British leader since Margaret Thatcher, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Theresa May was stiff and white, but she was a woman.
There were reasons for, you know, both British in general and conservatives to like Boris Johnson. In many ways, like I've looked at him, he's basically a Harry Potter character come to life. You can see him as the guest professor at one of those years.
Yeah, the deadly arts professor, yes. Yeah.
But his entire, you know, background was boarding schools and all the right circles and all, you know, like there was no, the weird thing is that he could occasionally strike this populist look by this populist, you know, chord, one through Brexit, but two just by being this constantly disheveled.
Outlandish. An outlandish character.
It didn't matter what time of day, what situation, whichever world leader he was meeting, he always looked like he just got out of bed.
And of course he showed up in Kyiv first. God bless him.
No, and then he would do so, or this, you know, video of him, you know, flying the plane yesterday.
Yes.
By the way, there's nothing like saying, hey, you know what, they're going to throw me out of office. I might as well do whatever the heck I
Let's
want.
Let's get behind an F-18 Super Hornet or a Typhoon.
What are they going to do? Throw me out? You know, Churchill got thrown out, too. I've finally emulated my hero. You know? Boris Johnson had his strengths. I think it's also very clear that both the party and probably the British public as a whole kind of got tired of his shtick. There's also a sense that, like, boy, if you were going to take over the reins of a major world power, summer 2019 was a rough. You didn't realize just what a storm you were about to step into.
I got to say, by the way, never Trumpers are going to hate when I say this. When Donald Trump was on this show 6 months ago, he said, you know, Boris has really gone all in on the climate stuff. That's really bad. And you know what? It is really bad. And his tax policy is really bad. It's not Thatcherism at all, Jim Garrity.
The irony is, you know, like by, you know, obviously the political dynamics have always been a little bit different over there. You saw that in that surprisingly close relationship between George W. Bush and Tony Blair of the Labor Party, at least on international and, you know, war on terror issues. The British Conservative Party, you know, Boris was going to be really tough on Brexit, which I think a lot of conservatives, both here and there, would say was important. But he was going to be something of a new Democrat, Bill Clinton centrist at most on a bunch of these other issues. And the idea is that you'd give Labor, you know, nowhere to run, that there was, you know, he was significantly to the left that he would make them look like a fringe. And it helped it, by the way, that Labor had nominated its own fringe candidates. But in the end, this is a, you know, if you don't give people a choice, that's when you get these real intense populist undercurrents going, because people argue about, you know, well, it's like we've got a mono party. You know, there are two.
Yeah. And by the way, Kemi Badenoch is a huge would be a Tory Obama, but Rishi Sunak would be the first Indian Brit, Brit of Indian descent, to do this too. And I mean, that's an enormous thing, right?
Yeah, every once in a while, you talk to someone who's British, particularly during the Obama years. And they would sense this almost this sense of envy, right? This recognition that, look, America's got a messy, ugly history, particularly in its treatment of African Americans. And yet somehow, obviously, we've gone through enormous struggles to become a more perfect union, a more equal country. And a lot of people, I think one of the big reasons Obama got elected is people say, aha, you know what? When we have a black president, that will mean racism is gone. Obviously, it hasn't quite worked out that way. Obviously, was it Iowa Hawk who kept saying my favorite part of the Was it Iowa Hawker X John who kept saying, my favorite part of the Obama era is all the racial healing?
Are you going to force me to disclose again that I am Iowa Hawk? I do that annually anyway on Twitter. Jim Garrity, get his National Review newsletter. Go over to nationalreview.com, sign up for it, subscribe to National Review, and read everything he does. Thank you, Jim. Big Jim Garrity. We just love having the indispensable one come join. Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt. I hold in my hand a fabulous thriller, Brad Storr's Rising Tiger, in bookstores everywhere at Amazon.com. I just tweeted out. I'm happy to welcome back my friend Brad. Brad, congratulations. This is fabulous.
Thank you, Hugh. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
The music is terrible, though. You know, I always at the back when I'm getting ready for an author interview, I take notes, copious notes on what I want to talk about without giving away the story. And I also make notes of the music. Whether it's Sly or Earth, Wind & Fire or the Average White Band. I mean, you just kind of went, you indulged some wild streak there, Brad Thor.
I did. I thought that connecting over funk and R&B might be fun for my different characters from different cultures in the book.
It is very fun, especially if you're my age and you're much younger, but you obviously have heard the same music. Let me tell you what is the best thing about Rising Tiger, in my opinion. I know something about India. I know a lot more about India when I'm done with Rising Tiger. All right. I know about the Right Honorable Company. I know about the heroes of the British Empire. I know about the division of India. I know about Modi as our friend, and we need them in China. But I mean, you really got deep into the weeds on India. When did you decide on this direction?
Well, so, you know, when I do my thrillers every summer, I like to set them against an interesting, about to happen geopolitical backdrop. And two summers ago in real life, the opening of Rising Tiger actually happened. Indian troops crept across the line of actual control, the border region in the Himalayas, with handmade weapons. Chinese troops crept over onto the Indian side and attacked Indian soldiers with homemade weapons. They're not allowed to use firearms in this area. And it was a horrific medieval style, 6 hours of hand-to-hand brutal combat. And I was fascinated, and I wanted to look at this part of the world, in particularly during lockdown, when I realized how overdependent we were on the supply chain and manufacturing from China. And we're the oldest democracy in the world. India is the largest. They're a natural ally for us. So I'd reached out to our mutual friend, Robert O'Brien, to ask him some more questions about this part of the world. And I was fascinated what I learned about what the Trump administration had done. And the book's not about the Trump administration, but just why it was recognized that we needed deeper ties with India. And I said, none of my contemporaries have set a spy thriller in India. I'm going to do it. I think there's so much interesting stuff to pepper in there. So that's where Rising Tiger
pepper is advisable. I mean, food junkies will like this book a lot. I know you're a food junkie, Brad Thor. I am not. I don't know that I could eat even half of what Scott Harbutt gets through in his many days in India. But I didn't know that only one in three Indians drive. You know, I did know about ethnic conflict, but not at the level at which you said it, and not with the speed with which ethnic conflict can erupt. And I gather this riot referenced in Rising Tiger that took 53 lives is a real thing.
It is a real thing that happened in New Delhi. And that's part of the reason, doing my research, I was fascinated, particularly talking to Robert O'Brien, to learn that after the attack by Chinese troops on Indian soldiers, that the Modi government banned over 400 apps, Chinese apps, from the Indian App Store. They said, you've been gathering our biometric data, personal data on Indian citizens. And within about 3 years, there's going to be 1 billion smartphone users in India. It was a major blow to China's tech sector. But China uses those apps to push these mobs and these riots. They use it for fake news and to really manipulate the Chinese public. So to make a reference to that riot and all the people that were killed, this is what I like to do. I want to give people just a fun white knuckle thrill ride. But if they close one of my thrillers smarter, knowing a little bit more about a certain part of the world and why it's important to America, then I think that's the icing on the cake if you're a little smarter at the end.
And the cake is very good. We're after the break, we're going to come back, talk more about Rising Tiger. But I want people to understand great power competition is back. It's back in a Nixonian sort of way, is that India is a new player on the big board, even though the great game has gone on for 300 years with Russia and India. But here you really have brought great power competition. GPC is the big talk in all the military academies, Brad Thor. And in Rising Tiger, it's a lot more fun to learn it this way.
I hope so. I mean, that's my goal. Again, it's supposed to be toes in the sand, book in the hand, take it to the beach, take it to the lake this weekend. But I want you to walk away with a little bit better knowledge of why India is so strategic and so important, and why we should be considering beefing up the Quad and maybe creating, as I suggest in the book, an Asian version of NATO.
I've asked many people about whether NATO should become NATO. And North Atlantic Pacific Treaty Organization. And here I pick up Rising Tiger, and it's the theme of the book. And it is, the Quad is coming into being. The submarine deal is a big deal. And you talk about your villains are in Pakistan. Your villains are the Taliban. Your villains are the CCP. When we come back from break, Brad Thor is going to do a little bit of a deeper dive. We're not going to give it away. No spoilers. It's a Scott Harbutt novel. I can't give away too much. He uses a lot of weaponry. But Brad Thor's Rising Tiger in bookstores now. Go out and get it, America. Don't go anywhere. The rest of this podcast will be over at the Highly Concentrated You podcast later in the day. Don't go anywhere except to Amazon.com. Thank you, Adam. Thank you, Dwayne. America, keep listening and go get the book. I think I also wanted to tell you, Brad, that your shout out to Mike Waltz has traveled around D.C. You always got to read the Brad Thor acknowledgments to the very end. One of the things, don't turn, it's like you now put these MacGuffin things in, like the Marvel movies put in Easter eggs at the end. It's in the footnotes. Stay tuned, America. I'll be right back with more Brad Thor. Welcome back, America. Talking with Brad Thor now in detail about Rising Tiger. Brad, I made a list of things I did not know, just as a way to tease people in. I did not know that yogurt is the cure-all for spicy food.
It is. Yep.
When did you learn that? Is that experience or is that book research?
It actually was book research. And so I talked to friends who have gone over and consumed that particular item that I talk about in the book. And they had said, you want to have the yogurt on the side if you're even going to attempt it. So it's research.
Is a ghost pepper real in the United States?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So okay. We've got them and they're rough. Yes.
OK, I have not partaken in that. Number two, they want a Rembrandt. You suggest that they want a Rembrandt is a phrase in the espionage world. Explain what it means. And is that true or is that a Brad Thorism?
So it is part an ism. I've heard it kicked around, but not seriously with operators. But the idea behind a Rembrandt is that it's a very messy, very public, very bloody assassination. So there is quite the blood spatter on the wall. You catch somebody in a cafe or a restaurant, and it's not just the dead body hits the floor. It's everything that's left on the wall. So that's where the Rembrandt term comes from.
Page 316. You never know in this business, which I think, by the way, you've done a great public service in this book, and I got to talk about it carefully. But first, you never know in this business. I'm never surprised by any spy story. A spy turns up driving Dianne Feinstein. I'm not surprised. A spy turns up in Eric Swalwell's bed. I'm not surprised.
Yes.
Because I did counterespionage in the Reagan years when the Soviets were pretty good at this. And now the Chinese run circles around what they did in the 80s and the 90s.
Very, very true. So there is no such thing as coincidence is what I write about a lot in the book. And that's what my guys always say, is that it's just not coincidence. If you see somebody twice, somebody pops up where you don't expect them, that kind of thing. So that's one of the big rules in that game, is no such thing as coincidence.
Now, the dangerous thing about what we're about to talk about, a character in the novel, is that whenever Secretary of State Pompeo, a former Secretary of State, or former National Security Robert O'Brien said, we have to be very careful about Chinese nationals on visas in the United States, and we also have to be very careful not to implicate Chinese Americans, to distinguish the two. But a Chinese national in the United States under deep cover as a grad student is a very bad actor in Rising Tiger. Who told you about this? Because, by the way, it's real. It's a real problem.
Yeah. So I had a lot of talks with people in D.C. and asked them, I like to ask, what keeps you up at night? That's one question. And what do you think is not getting enough attention in the media? So that's where a lot of my ideas and the details in the book start to percolate. So we have a lot of very high ranking Chinese children, the children of high ranking Chinese that are in the country here. They refer to them as princelings, these kids from wealthy, powerful families of China that are going to elite American universities. So you're right when Secretary Pompeo says we need to make that distinction. But it is a continual problem that we have. And in fact, I was just listening to Robert O'Brien get interviewed the other day, and he was being asked, I think it was it Klon Kitchen that was interviewing him and asking him, and Klon comes from an intelligence background, what one of the greatest threats Robert sees to the United States. And he says, undoubtedly, it's the CCP and the theft of intellectual property. He said, you can go back to the sacking of Rome and you won't be able to find another theft that reaches the level of what the Chinese have stolen from the United States. So this issue of who's in the country and who should not be in the country and what are they doing here? How do you open up America to people that you want here, but how do you sift for the people that you don't want here? And that is a very delicate, very difficult game. And we continually find Chinese spies throughout. And Swalwell's a good example. We also were chasing a bunch of Chinese scientists. If you remember not too long ago, we chased them down to Texas and they started burning stuff outside their consulate there down in, I believe it was Houston. And then we ended up closing down, was it in San Francisco, where we closed a diplomatic outpost of theirs there. So it's ongoing. The FBI.
More than a decade ago, Brad, an AUSA in Orange County, California, who prosecutes Chinese espionage, told me this is a decade ago. We have no idea of the scale of espionage activities. Now, I tell people when they watch The Americans, the famous platform series about Soviet espionage, that I did that. And I know for a fact that the Soviets did not do wet work in the United States. I mean, they kill somebody in every episode of that show in the United States. And they did not do that. They didn't, even in Moscow rules and American rules. The Chinese, whether or not they do wet work, Do you have an idea? Because I have no idea. I haven't had a clearance since 1988. Do you think they do wet work in the United States?
Nothing has even been intimated to me that they do. So I have not heard of a single case. I've not heard somebody say, well, I can't tell you specifically. I haven't heard that with any of the people that I've done my research with.
But I do believe they very much are in the same old espionage of money, sex, and ideology. Ideology might not be so much anymore, but boy, do they lean on people whom they can lean on. That's one thing I learned from my friends in the last 10 years is that people are subject to being leaned on by virtue of family, extended family, are being leaned on by the CCP. You agree with that, Brad Thor?
What? Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the reasons that I was sorry not to see the Trump administration succeed in TikTok being sold. There are all these ways that the CCP keeps pressure on Chinese living in America. So if you've got any relatives back in China, that's a weak point that they can press on. And they press on it hard, trying to get people to do all sorts of things here they shouldn't be doing against the U.S.
Let me also talk about what I thought was a brilliant bit of literature, and I want to know if it's actually used. You've got to get a black op up and running in India. So the Indian intelligence services can't use an existing contractor for fear of compromise. So they go to a really hungry contractor who wants to sell their technology to the government and said, why don't you do a demo for us? And I thought that's actually kind of brilliant, Brad. Do you think that we actually do that? Because that would be brilliant.
I think we do. I think at some point you do need proof of concept. And so that is a way to get proof of concept, use the piece of technology in an operation. The technology provider thinks it's an exercise when it's actually a real operation and you get to see if the technology works. But more importantly, you've already done the review. You do believe the technology works. And this is a chance for you to use the technology off the books and not have that technology provider associated officially with your organization or with the operation.
Brad, a couple of things you wear your sleeve a little bit openly here. You've got a heart for people who are trapped in human trafficking and for the perverts who prey upon them. And you kind of, mm-hmm. I kind of recoil from the perversion. It's not explicit. It's not X-rated. It's R-rated for violence, but you don't get into it, but you mention it. And I just said, oh, don't go there. And it reminded me of something else. Where did that come from?
Well, Chinese stick out like sore thumbs everywhere that isn't China, basically. Yes. Outside of Asia, they really stick out. And they stick out tremendously in India. So it's very difficult for Chinese intelligence officers to work in India. So they need a third country party to do their work. Best of all, they get an Indian to do their bad work, or they get somebody who doesn't stand out. And so that's why I had the Chinese via the Belt and Road Initiative. I'm very concerned about the influence China has over Pakistan. So I have China. Basically, you know, they've got billions of dollars in Pakistan and they lean on the ISI to give them an intelligence operative who's based in India to do China's bad deeds there. So I wanted to make that character even more despicable. And I went on the hunt. I actually looked for some just very, very bad proclivities. And in my 2 decades of writing, I'd never seen the stuff that I put in Rising Tiger for that Pakistani.
It's a bad guy.
ISI
it's bad
officer.
Guy. It's a bad guy. It's bad yeah. guy. Now let me talk to you about other things. I didn't know that Indians had P-8s. This is great that they've got P-8s.
Robert O'Brien, he told me about it. He said, you got to put that in the book, that they have the P-8s. I mean, that's an amazing aircraft. And the fact that we shared it with India so they can do long range kind of naval reconnaissance and sub hunting and things like that says a lot about the partnership that we have and we want to deepen with India. And what a perfect time to kind of cleave the Russians away from them. We want the Indians buying our military equipment, not those Russian missile systems and the MiGs and things like that. So it's just I lucked out with the timing of this book, I think.
I love the fact that you've got someone subscribing to the Blaze in here as well, Brad Thor. Next time, though, they might want to, you know, listen to Dwayne's after show. I'm just suggesting to you, if you want Dwayne to book this again.
It came out of a podcast where I got teased.
Really? That's very funny.
No, that was a joke.
All right. I caught it. I thought that was very funny. Now, I just watched 2 months ago something called Tokyo Vice. It's a very good HBO series. And it's about
my daughter loved it.
Okay. It's a very, very well done HBO series. My son recommended it to me. I watched it. And then I see the soda pop war. And I think to myself, there's organized crime in every country. Is this real or is this part of Brad Thor's very fertile imagination? What is it, Brad?
It's real. It's real. The soda pop war happened in India in the criminal underground. Yeah, it the stuff that I found researching my thriller was just unbelievable. And the soda pop war had to go in there. I couldn't believe it was true. I had to source it through a couple of different places. But it happened in India. It's amazing.
I hope people are beginning to understand now that you learn stuff. For example, the way of the samurai is a real thing. I mean, people, yes. It's not just made up. It's a real thing.
Mm-hmm.
Brad, I think you can go anywhere you want. I just compliment you for going to the subcontinent. I also want to compliment you on page 224 for your admonition to Americans backhanded to practice gratitude. I mean, that's kind of a funny thing coming in a Scott Harvath novel, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I got that through a mutual friend. You know Jonah Goldberg, and he had his book that I blurbed his book, Suicide of the West, which I think is one
Great
of
book.
The greatest nonfiction books of the last decade. It's fantastic. And that book was about gratitude, that we are on the top of the mountain, and it's the best time in the history of the world to live in the best country in the history of the world. And if we lean too far forward, too far back, too far left, too far right, we're going to lose our footing. And we need to practice gratitude. There's a lot to be upset about, but there's even more to be grateful for. And I thought that was an important thing to stick in the book, the idea of gratitude.
I liked it. I applaud it. I think it was terrific. I want to close by talking about some of the Indian, and this is subcontinent Indian, phrases. When a camel is at the foot of a mountain, only then can you judge its height. There's a lot of sort of Indian lore in here. And I go back to, since I'm a student of the British Empire and I enjoyed reading, you know, the Right Honorable Company and all that kind of stuff, there's a lot of it that's known, but much of it unknown. How much of this book was new to you, Brad Thor? Because Rising Tiger, there's a lot that's new to me, and that's hard, actually, for a thriller to do for me anymore.
I'll tell you, it's the hardest book that I ever wrote, Hugh. I had to do a lot of research, and unfortunately, I wanted to go to India, but the Delta variant was ravaging India, and my wife said, listen, you catch COVID, you don't catch COVID. She goes, that's actually the least of my worries. She said, I'm afraid you get in a car accident over there. She said, knowing you and your love of motorcycles, you get hit while you're on a motorcycle. She said, you won't be able to get into an emergency room. They're just overflowing. And so unfortunately, I couldn't go, but it made me double down on my research, reach out to more people. My children's godfather had been based at the U.S. Embassy in New Delhi. That was helpful. I've got a former DSS agent, Fred Burton, who was very helpful explaining how they hire an ex-powerful cop at our embassies to help navigate the local law enforcement network.
He's a great character, by the way. I like his Jaguar. I like everything about him, and he's a terrific character. I hope he comes back in the future. Now I want to close with crass commercialism. I think people should buy Rising Tiger because it's a toes in the sand book in the handbook, but also because it teaches them. I'm just curious, has Scott Harvath entered the lexicon like Mitch Rapp did? Has he not like bumped Mitch Rapp? They're running down the road together because they are such branded people. You can't write a book without him.
You know what? I got to tell you, I love writing this character, and I've built, you know, over 21 books. I tell people they're like the James Bond movies. You don't need to have seen all the Bond movies to go to the theater and see the latest one. And same thing with the books. I love writing this character because he's grown to represent so many of the people I know in the intelligence community, the special operations community, elements of people in the diplomatic corps. So he's really come to resemble America for me and the promise of America and what America can do when they put their mind to it. And I also like to think that we've got a few of these guys out there that are allowed to break the rules in service of the mission. And that's that whole Wild Bill Donovan thing. If you fall forward in service of the mission. Yeah.
Last question. You begin the book in Afghanistan after the collapse. We're coming up on the 1 year anniversary. I got to talk to Tim Kennedy next week about his book, which is the reality of going in to grab a few thousand people out of the embers. It scarred a lot of people. I'm glad you began your book with it. How late in the day did you have to make that choice?
You know what? It was there from the beginning. I really wanted to do something. What would it be like having to go back in and pull out a loyal Afghan intelligence operative who had agreed to stay behind after the collapse to spy for us? I had this idea. I wanted to create escape from New York, send in Snake Plissken to get this family out of Kabul. And that was kind of the idea, with a very dramatic exit, you know, have Harvath just barely make it out. And it's the longest continuous action scene I've ever written in one of my novels.
I was wondering,
a lot of people are pointed to that.
It goes to it, and it's a great way to jumpstart. And by the way, you know he's going to live, or it's a very short book. And so, but who, you don't know who else is going to live, right? And you're going to learn a lot about Tajikistan and many other things. Brad Thor, congratulations on Rising Tiger, bestseller per usual. Have a great book tour, my friend. Be well.
Thank you, Hugh. You too.
Thank you.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.